Good morning and welcome. Welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it's my pleasure to welcome you here this morning. You know, I look out in the audience and I see some red popping, red sweaters, skirts, scarves, so we know that it must be December, right? Pretty close to Christmas. So I certainly want to take this opportunity to, first of all, thank you all for coming today and throughout the year. Thank you all for listening, those of you at WCNY FM. And wish you happy holidays, happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas, and certainly a happy New Year, because, as you know, today is the last program of this year, of 2012. And we take a semester break, and then we come back on February 7th. And we have a great series of programs lined up already for February, and you'll be hearing from me about that in January. So speaking of the holidays, obviously a lot of people have been shopping for gifts and doing their holiday shopping, and I have too, so I wanted to tell you about it because I noticed that on the Sunday newspaper in the Post Standard, there was an article, a front page news story about someone's shopping and pictures and all of the rest. And so I wanted to tell you about where I've been doing my shopping. And I've been doing a little bit of shopping on Pearl Street this past Saturday, where there's a great wine store. And we had some cheese and salami a couple doors up the street at another shop. We made our way up North Salina Street, picked up some gifts, and of course ended up at the other end at a bakery where we got yet more food. And around the corner at a craft shop where I bought some great t-shirts for my daughters that, I shouldn't have said that, but anyways, presents for my daughters that have a map of Syracuse with all of the Syracuse neighborhoods mapped out on them. Then we went to dinner at this brand new restaurant on Westcott Street. It was great, great food, great service, great ambiance. Parked for free right across the street, on the street. And they were all locally owned shops. So that was a great thing. And if next time I go shopping, I'll let you know and you can follow me, take my picture, put me on Syracuse.com. That'll be great. That will be great. So. So that was fun. Maybe we'll ask our guest speaker today about his holiday shopping, because I saw him on Capitol Tonight the other night, and Liz Benjamin just avoided that question entirely. Somehow it did not make her list of hard-hitting questions. So, Senator DeFrancisco, thank you for being here today. We really appreciate it. It's been too long since we had you here. For those of you who don't know, John DeFrancisco was first elected to the state Senate in 92. So he's been in the Senate for 20 years, and congratulations on your recent reelection. He serves as chairman still of the Senate Finance Committee, and his position on this powerful committee allows him to play a significant role in reviewing the budget. And I know we're going to have a lot of questions for him about that. He has, in 20 years, needless to say, introduced, sponsored a lot of legislation, been successful in representing his constituents in the Syracuse area in many ways. So I leave you to check out his website biography for that one, so we don't take up too much room. So lifelong resident of Syracuse, and I didn't know this, graduate of SU with an engineering degree before you went off to law school. So welcome.
Thank you.
I thought she was going on and on. Since she wanted to limit my time, and I didn't want to make that happen. Secondly, I shop with Bill Magnarelli at the Carousel Mall. So if you ever want to, I just haven't gotten there yet. Now, it's interesting that I learned today, I knew it was a long time, but I didn't realize this Thursday Morning Roundtable has been going on for 47 years. It's an amazing accomplishment, and I hope that, and I know that, the reason is there's a great administration, and you get good speakers that are interesting, and you got people that are interested in the community like yourselves. And so, you know, it's you know, it's very difficult to imagine that any organization can last for 47 years nowadays, but it's a real tribute. So I was able to answer that question very quickly as to why you've been around 47 years. I've been in government for 35 years. I started on the school board, city council, president of the city council, 20 years in the Senate. And the question I can't understand is why I've only been invited 3 times in 35 years. Maybe we'll figure it out after what I have to say today. But it's interesting. I'll just tell you very briefly, 25 years ago about, I was here speaking about the elimination of the Board of Estimate in the city of Syracuse. Many of you who are my age group remember that, where it was a group comprised of the mayor, the president of the city council, and the mayor's self-appointed finance commissioner, which meant the mayor always made all decisions through this, not through the city council, but through this body. And we and it's interesting what happened. I talked about this back then. And what happened was I actually drafted myself, because the then corporation council did not want to do it. And I drafted myself. We ended up getting a proposition on the ballot to eliminate the Board of Estimate. And the paper editorialized against it. If it ain't broken, don't fix it. Well, it lost. The proposition went down. About a year later, the then mayor had some legal difficulties. We put the same proposition on the ballot, and it passed overwhelmingly. And that was topic back 25 years ago. So those who weren't here 25 years ago, you got a little update. About 6 years ago, I spoke on a project that's known to all of us here in the community and gave my point of view, and I promised publicly never to speak of it again, unless more benefits were requested. And that was a different topic at a different time. Now what's topical today with respect to the Senate is this new arrangement that's being worked out as far as Senate leadership. And it's kind of an unusual situation, but let me give you a little history about it and what I think, how it's gonna work, and what I think will happen as a result of this. And once again, I'm speaking as of today. Tomorrow, it may be all different. You just never know in politics. But it all started really back in 2009 when the New York City Democrats, and I say that clearly and it's correct, actually won the majority in the New York State Senate. And at that time, and for many, many years, the assembly has been controlled by New York City Democrats. And the governor was a Democrat from New York City by the name of David Paterson. And what happened was the agenda was extremely New York City centric, to put it mildly. In the past, the Senate was controlled by upstate and Long Island. And what happened was whenever there was a bailout of the MTA, the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, there'd be road and bridge money upstate. There would be some compromise so that upstate was not ignored in the process. That stopped immediately during that period of time. During that period of time, it was during that two-year period when the New York City Democrats controlled the Senate, spending went up by $14 billion. Taxes went up by $14 billion. I personally did not believe that that was the appropriate thing to do in the time that we were in with respect to the financial problems of the state of New York. So there was a coup attempt. Does anybody remember that? Okay. Well, I think two of the four who were involved, actually three, two of the three are now in jail. One went yesterday, and another will be in jail very soon. So they weren't very reliable human beings to be dealing with. And that coalition with the Republicans lasted about 2 days, I think. And they went back to the New York City Democrats, and they completed the two-year cycle. Republicans gained control in the non-presidential year 2 years ago. And there were four Democrats that didn't want to be part of the New York City coalition. And interestingly enough, two of them were from New York City and are from New York City, Diane Savino and Jeff Klein. The other two, Carlucci is from the Mid-Hudson area, and Dave Valesky is in the office across the hall from me at the state office building. And they did not want to be part of that conference. Now, you can argue all you want about the merits of that and so forth. They decided not to become part of that conference. They formed their independent conference, and much of their agenda got on the calendar over the last couple years. And in fact, there were some instances where the Republicans didn't have enough votes to carry some of the legislation, and they supported some of the legislation we want. And on the other hand, interestingly enough, because we have another person involved in government in the state of New York with a 70%+ favorability rating, and he had a lot of influence on what came on the agenda. And despite during the 2 years of New York City Democrat control, unlike during that 2 year period, same-sex marriage passed with a Republican majority leader. Shocking, but it happened. In any event, there became a close relationship with the four that did not want to become a member of that conference. So, fast forward to about a month ago, the election results come in, and it became pretty apparent that the Republicans, if they won the majority, it was going to be extremely close. And in fact, two races are still being tallied. One, the Democrats are going to win. Steve Saland's district, he was punished for voting for the same-sex marriage, and by a third-party candidate taking enough votes, so he lost after being in the Senate for 22 years. The other one, a new Senate seat, and those of whom were critical of redistricting, found out that the new Senate district seat that was created for a Republican is now in a runoff. We're in the courts arguing vote after vote every day, and we don't know how that's going to go. So what ended up happening is shortly after the election, discussions began. I was involved with some of them. Discussions began concerning whether or not the four independent Democrats would want to continue on with us. Well, obviously, in view of their additional importance at this point in time, instead of just being associates with our Senate Republicans, they became full partners. And that partner, as Liz Benjamin said, she was quoting Jim Seward, one of the upstate Republicans. He said, before the four Democrats were engaged to Republicans, now they're married. And and I didn't agree with that characterization, but it's probably pretty close. And so what's going to happen now, according to news releases and everything that I know, there's going to be a joint leadership in the Senate, and Dean Skelos and Jeff Klein are going to be doing it jointly. Now, how do they do that? What's the format? Well, one of the most criticized portion of it, I think, is criticized because I don't think people understand what the difference is between the president pro tem and the majority leader. Every 2 weeks, one will be president pro tem, then the other becomes president pro tem 2 weeks later, and so forth and so on. The only significance of president pro tem in the Constitution is in a matter of succession to the governor. If the lieutenant governor if something happens to the governor and the lieutenant governor, something happens to the lieutenant governor, then it's the president pro tem of the Senate. And if you think that's far-fetched, well, it happened, because Eliot Spitzer also had his problems, and he left before his term was over, and the unsuspecting lieutenant governor became governor, and no one knew what would happen in the event the governor went down, and at the time it would have been the president pro tem of the Senate. So I'm going a little off ground, but this is kind of interesting. This has happened before, and never has the governor appointed a lieutenant governor, never in the history of the state of New York, no matter how many times. But the governor did appoint someone. Patterson appointed Ravitz, very distinguished public servant over many, many years. and immediately upon appointing him, he ignored everything he had to say. But so he became a lieutenant governor like all the other lieutenant governors in the history of the state of New York. But it went to court. It went all the way to the highest court of the state. And despite there being nothing in the Constitution allowing this, they came up with the most convoluted discussion that allowed the governor to make this appointment. So that's just a little side note that you could read the decision and determine whether you feel it's convoluted or not. So basically, that's the significance of President Pro Tem. And we probably will never get to that point again, but so it depends when something happens to the governor, lieutenant governor, who happens to be governor, depending upon one week you serve. But as the practical workings of the Senate, the majority leader, and it's always been the same, majority leader and president pro tem, but they broke that off. The majority leader, the two of them will jointly decide on legislation that goes on the calendar, jointly decide on various appointments and the like, and basically run the Senate together. Now, many are saying that this is not going to work, and we'll see whether it works or not. But the difference now, I think, is that there's been 2 years of this group working together, and there is a level of trust. There's no question there's a level of trust. There's going to be debates concerning what goes on the calendar. There's going to be arguments. There's going to be people unhappy one way or the other. But there has to be a joint decision for things to get on the calendar. Now, enter the governor. The governor entered, and he hasn't really entered into the dispute until really now. And he gave us, and I got to look at the list because I don't want to know what they are, but he gave us a litmus test to judge the state of New York Senate. And some of the things he feels are important to happen that he doesn't care who the leadership is as long as they get done: campaign finance reform, increasing the minimum wage, reform of the New York State stop and frisk policy. That's an interesting one, but basically, if you get stopped and frisked and you got up to a baggie of marijuana on you, you can't be charged. So safest place for your marijuana in the city and the state of New York will be in your pocket if this policy changes. Environmental protection and initiatives that address our changing climate, education and Medicaid budget rate formulas, providing fiscal stability, et cetera, and so on. And he's got a litmus test of 10. And so he will be involved in this process, no doubt. He was involved in his priorities, no doubt, with Sheldon Silver as well as Dean Skelos over the last couple years. And quite frankly, they were extremely productive years, in my judgment. And as a practical matter, there's no reason that the next 2 years will not be productive. So he will be involved in this process, cajoling, trying to get compromises on some of these pieces of legislation, and more importantly, cooperating with the Senate and the Assembly on some things they may want in their priorities to try to get a good agenda and to move the state forward, as I believe he has been doing over the last couple of years. So some have criticized the governor for not getting involved in this process. I think in his defense, I believe very strongly that the most important thing for the state is to get things done and not be dysfunctional as we were, in my judgment, especially for 2009 and 2010, and to show that the government can work. And that's his main goal. And the worst thing he could have done is, with that regard, is to get in the middle of this mess that pleases nobody, but I think will work. And by the way, this is kind of interesting. Things just keep coming through my mind. I don't know why they do. But at the end of the legislative session in 2011, I was chairman of finance, and I got a call from an NPR radio station in California. And California's been having their problems with budgets, obviously. And we had a Democrat assembly, a Republican Senate, and a Democrat governor, and we got the budget done not only on time, but we cut spending, and it was, I think, a very fiscally prudent budget. They called me, and I was on live radio in LA explaining how the state of New York government can be so functional. And it was so dysfunctional in California. And they obviously didn't read papers here over the prior couple of years. But that is really one of the governor's most important goals, I think, is to get things done and to do it in a professional way. So I believe it's going to work. For Central New York, it's extremely important. And, you know, you can be a Democrat or Republican, but there's few people who could argue with the concept that if you have a totally New York City-oriented government with leaders in each house and a governor from the same area, it's tough enough in upstate New York to get what's called a fair share or to get things that have to get done here in relation to the giant down in the city. And with this coalition, there are still two of the four, now five. Malcolm Smith is joined as well. And I was asked what I thought about that. I said, I don't think about it because the independent Democrats can decide whoever is involved in their conference. None of my business. But two of them are from New York City. And we've got two New York City, now three with Malcolm Smith. We have two New York City Republicans. So the New York City is represented. But on the other hand, so is the rest of the state. When the Democrats controlled the Senate, there were 32 majority members. 23 of the 32 weren't from downstate, 23 were from New York City. And then all about four others, except four others, were either from Westchester or Long Island, close to the city. So I guess the point is that there's definitely a much better chance of regional equity or some type of regional fairness as far as the governing of the Senate, and we think that this will help, especially with, I'm pretty sure, well, I do know, what committee Dave Valesi is going to have is going to be a very important committee. I assume that I'll still have the committee. Nothing's final until we vote on January 9th, and then it's probably not final after that. But it appears that that's the way it's going to be, and it's going to be very, very helpful for Central New York. Now, I don't know, what's the time here? Am I close? Because I can go into a different time. Okay. All right. So I'm going to open it up for questions early, but I just wanted to mention one other thing that ties into what I just said. Central New York, I'm on the Central New York Regional Economic Development Council, which also is somewhat important because this is the group that recommends the various projects to the governor for funding. It's one-stop shopping now. It's not like you have 16 different places to go. The regional economic development application goes on, you do it online, and then then it gets reviewed, it gets scored, and then ultimately we make recommendations locally, then it goes to the agencies and the governor for final determination. And there's going to be some excellent projects, I believe, that are going to be approved because it's now just about through the agency process. And ultimately, I'm sure the governor is going to approve many of these projects, which is important for Central New York. Dave Valesky has some projects that we've promoted as well. And I just think that Central New York representation, other than shopping at Carousel Mall, Bill Magnarelli is on this Regional Economic Development Council, and he's promoting various projects. And I'm hearing that December 19th, these projects are going to be publicly announced. It'll definitely be before Christmas, I would think. But it was postponed because of the hurricane, the announcements. But I think there are going to be some excellent projects for Central New York. Lastly, for those who really say, you know, this is not right. The Democrats win. They should control. They are the bot. They are, it's the way government works. That's the way it should be. And it's just Republicans should be the minority again. The people decided. The people made their decision. Well, you know, it's an interesting thing because those are the same people, and you may be some of them, who are upset and absolutely mortified about how government works, and it's not bipartisan. Because if you look what's going on in Washington, that's what we used to be like in some of our history in the state Senate. And that's not the way to get things done. So if you really, truly believe in bipartisan government, this is an experiment. We don't know if it's going to work. We think it will. In bipartisan government that's going to jointly come up with an agenda, jointly vote your conscience on the agenda, and who knows, maybe it's something that might be replicated elsewhere if it works as well as I think it will. So with that said, I'll be more than happy to open it up for questions, and we have one already. Yes.
Please.
You may be one of the few legislators in the state of New York who understands the school funding formula. And I know you've supported equitable funding for the schools. Do you believe that with this new realignment that we'll finally address equity funding for low-wealth districts like Syracuse and other poor districts?
There's a good possibility, but before I get too excited about it, let me tell you the political realities of life. The political reality is if you are benefiting by the formula, you don't want it to change. If you're not benefiting the formula, you want it changed. As a practical matter, when you count the votes in both houses, not just the Senate, the votes aren't there. Whether they'll be there now, one of the things I just mentioned here, in reading it, one of the governor's priority, the education and Medicaid budget rate formulas that provide fiscal predictability and sustainability. It's one of his litmus tests. So, for that reason, with him being the 800-pound gorilla in the room, and being very successful at it with an outstanding favorability rating, there's a better chance that that'll happen than ever. I've sponsored a bill when I was in the majority. The 2 years that I wasn't, Valesky sponsored a bill to change the formula, not only change the way it's written, but to make it so simple that if you're in Long Island or you're in Syracuse, you can figure out whether or not you're being treated fairly. And so it was transparent, and I'm going to continue to push it as I know Dave is, and we'll see whether we can get it done.
Thank you.
Good morning, Senator. My name is Andrea Wandersee, and I am so glad you made those final points in your talk about bipartisan support. I guess my question is, when we're talking about this particular instance here in New York State, we're talking about Democrats making a shift in their formal allegiance or whatnot. At the national level, the Republicans pay very little attention to upstate New York, let alone New England. How does the Republican Party, how do you sort of perceive your role in the big picture, and to what extent, you know, is there ever going to be a day where the Republicans are going to be the ones who make this step towards bipartisanship and do the compromise?
Well, I suspect that you're a Democrat. See, that's why I keep getting elected all the time, because I'm really, really smart. With respect to the bipartisanship, New York City and New York State sends more money to Washington than we get back. The reimbursement on Medicaid is nowhere close of what we should be getting. And if I'm not mistaken, we have two Democrat senators, and who have some authority over budget matters as well. It depends on who you want to blame in the process. I've been involved in these knockdown, drag-out negotiations in the state on various budget issues, and the problem is the players, not necessarily the party. And it depends who the players are. If the players are reasonable human beings that understand that everything is not a political point to earn, then you can get things done. And I can say the same thing, in my opinion, that the president is being intractable. But that's my opinion. But the fact of the matter is that there's a guideline that everybody could save face on, and that's the report that was done by Simpson and Bowles, was it? That, you know, it hurts everybody, and there's a chance that something could die. It seems to me that if you got an independent group that you appoint as president, you should at least show some support for the results that that report says. And I would think if they started with that framework, you wouldn't have to blame anybody. You would just make the changes and get it done. But for either side to say, start the name game, it doesn't help. And so you can blame both parties, and hopefully something will break very soon, and maybe we can get bipartisanship on the federal level as well.
Senator, really great to see the movement in the Senate and building a coalition and something that...
I can't hear you, Mitch.
Let me turn off the microphone. I think it's really terrific, and it's really great. But the assembly is still there. And, I mean, how do you see the relationship with the assembly, and is there any way of building that same kind of spirit with the assembly? And do you really need that? Or with the governor's participation, is there enough power to get things done without the assembly?
You got it right there. And it's not without the assembly, but when you have a governor that's got this favorability rating and 2 years of accomplishment, that's how you get both sides together and both houses together. As far as bipartisanship, as a practical matter, if it's 2-1 control by one party and a majority of that control is New York City, then no matter who's the speaker, it's going to be very difficult not to listen to the majority of your majority. So I don't fault anybody, including the speaker, on the makeup of their group, but it's unlikely in the near future that there's going to be a closer margin, which would require bipartisanship. So I don't see it happening, but I think you hit it on the head with the governor. That's why things have been getting done.
Good morning, Senator.
Sarah, I am shocked that you have a question. I really.
But this is softball time.
Okay.
The governor gave a litmus test to the senators. Of those, are there two or three that you could get behind to help the development of Central New York get on stronger legs?
Well, there's more than two or three. I think most of them. It depends on the details of what these bills say. As far as whether, and I think most of them in some form are going to happen. But to say if I can get behind any one of them, I think in theory all of them make some sense. The Republicans reportedly, and I think it's true, were against the minimum wage increase in and of itself, but we had other proposals because we're concerned about the smallest of businesses that want to survive as well. Maybe there's some potential tax credits that can be given to offset some of the burden on the smallest of the organizations. So there's going to be compromise on each one of these things, but I think none of these are off bounds. I don't think at all, especially when you see some of the things that happened over the last couple of years. So I think all of them are fair areas that are going to be compromised, and especially with the support of the governor.
Senator, enjoy your presentation. And I remember when the Democrats took over the Senate, one prominent Democratic senator said, well, after all these years in the wilderness, it's time, words to the effect that it's now time to show the Republicans what it's like to be in the wilderness. And so I know that there wasn't bipartisanship on either side for a number of years, and after the switch. But now, and after the last 2 years, what I'd like to ask is, right from the starting bell, when the senators get together to determine the rules for the next session, do you see prospects for change, for development of, say, more empowerment of individual senators? Do you see prospects for even division of resources among senators? And then I guess I would like to ask also about member items. Do you see a return of member items? And if so, is there going to be equitable sharing of those resources?
Okay, with respect to staffs, that was done in the rules last year. There's a set amount for all senators, and obviously the committee chairs would be in the majority, whether it's the coalition or a party. because for the practical matter, chairing the Finance Committee is a hell of a lot more work than being the, and you need more staff to understand what's going on, than having been ranking member on the Finance Committee, my main job asking questions of Carl Krueger, who now I have to get visitation rights in order to go ask questions. So, but in any event, that has already been done to a large extent. As far as member empowerment, there's rules now. I believe it's going to expand, quite frankly. And lastly, member items, I certainly hope they'll come back. You know, people denigrate the member items that we would bring back to the community, and it would be, I think it will be equitable as well. It would have to be. But there's no real prospects. The last 4 years, there really hasn't been any, and it's very difficult to do. And many, many nonprofit organizations used to benefit from these items. And I always used to say, and hope we'll be able to say again, that this is pork to those that don't get it, but tenderloin to those that do. And as long as you're doing it properly and providing funding for the proper organizations, well, I don't think it should be criticized. Especially when you look at the governor's office now, the governor's office has broad discretion on a lot of grants. So to suggest that government doesn't provide things for some and not others, I think would be a misconception. Yes.
There's been some rumblings about replacing Shelley, which to me seems highly unlikely given the Democratic majority. But and also the failed attempt several years ago. Do you see any changes, however, in the Assembly comparable to what's occurring right now in the Senate?
I really don't. You're right. The Bragman situation clearly empowered Shelley. Sort of what happened then was sort of like the leader of a coup announcing 3 weeks before that he was going to have a coup. And it gave plenty of opportunity for Shelley to bring his troops together and get things done. And even if he was not going to run, I honestly thought, I was the only person in the state, I didn't think he was going to run this year. I really and truly didn't. But I was obviously very wrong. But the talk was that if he didn't run, who would be the leader? And there's no real person behind him. So that's another reason why his position is extremely secure until he decides to say sayonara.
Good morning, Senator.
Good morning, Ed.
It's a follow-on to our earlier conversation.
Always a pleasure.
Yes, sir. My question goes to elections, election administration, something near and dear to my heart. But what it goes to is the date of the primaries. Regular primaries, not presidential. And while there are so many things at the federal level has come down in terms of when you're supposed to mail out ballots and stuff, that would almost require that we move it up from a September date to at least into August, but hopefully into July somewhere, never seems to go anywhere. And didn't seem to be on the governor's list of top 10 or whatever either. Do you see any change of anything because of this shift that might make that happen?
I really don't, because if the primary, you're talking about the primaries, the primary moving from September to August, there's not much interest in either house, quite frankly, of having primaries during people's summer vacation. One of the big issues, even though the primary was in September, the court proceedings on the one Senate race that really hasn't been determined yet, is residency. There's some people that have residences in upstate counties and live in New York, and they were voting in this race in the upstate county, which is part of the new Senate district that's in dispute now, and that would happen even more. And some of the legal issues that are coming up, where your primary residence is and whether you got to count this vote and that vote, I just don't see it happening. I truly don't, for that reason primarily.
Good morning, Senator.
Good morning, Peg.
I saw you at the local hearing that the Education Reform Commission held, so I know that you're interested in this issue. I think the commission holds a lot of promise in terms of bringing some new initiatives that might turn around the outcomes that children are experiencing in our schools, particularly schools, districts like Syracuse that are very low income. But I'm worried because we're hearing from the governor's office that the cost of Superstorm Sandy is going to prevent us from doing some of the things that might be possible. Where do you see those costs playing into the budget in this year?
It's going to play a significant role. We had a $4 billion gap when the governor came in, and we somehow were able to put it together. The governor actually renegotiated some public employees' contracts, which were unheard of, in order to avoid certain layoffs. I don't see this helping at all. 99% of the answer to your question is going to be how much is actually going to come from the federal government for Sandy. That will give us a better indication. But in any case, it's not going to be the total cost, and it's just another huge number that we're going to have to deal with. And so it's we're hearing rumblings that there might be another CFE lawsuit by poor districts to start that process over again. But realistically, Sandy's going to have a huge impact on funding of everything, for that matter. And unless this economy starts turning around, which it hasn't yet, because revenues are a few hundred million less than projected from last year's budget, which is not much. It sounds like a lot, but it's not much at the state level. But it's going to be a serious, serious problem. The governor's going to release his budget usually mid-January, and we'll have a better indication at that time. But it's not going to be easy. The president came out with a statement that he's recommended $50 billion for the Northeast. Well, I don't know what's going to happen through the legislative process, but that's a very favorable sign. But that's got to be shared by other states other than New York.
John, economic activity seems to be geographic specific. We've got counties down along the southern border between New York and Pennsylvania that would love to leave New York State and become part of Pennsylvania. Where do you think that stands? They keep kicking that decision down the road. Are we going to be still studying whether we should?
Are you asking about hydrofracking without using the term? Is that? I would have bet that the governor would have issued regulations and went forward with limited hydrofracking before about a month ago. There was a time frame when you have to reopen public comment period, and I would have bet my house on the fact that he would have come up with a limited pilot program in the counties that really want it. He didn't. He decided to get a report done and experts looking at it. But I still feel the same way that's what he's going to ultimately do, because the public comment period was only extended for a month. And I don't know what can be said that hasn't been said over the last 3 years on this topic, but there'll be more comments, probably the same type of comments. My guess is there's a bunch of communities that have expressed legislatively through their local governments that they don't want it. That's in the courts, but there's a lot of southern tier areas that want it. So I got a feeling he's going to do a pilot program with regulations, with serious security being posted by the hydrofrackers and the cost of doing this sufficiently secured in case there's some type of problem, and do it on a limited basis. That's what I think is going to happen. And by the way, the head of the DEC is Martins, who got an advanced degree from ESF, and he's a tree hugger, to use that phrase. And you know, it's not like we have the head of Exxon as our DEC. So I think the regulations are going to be extremely restrictive and very cautious. But I think that's what's going to happen. Yes.
For years and years, the state went without a state budget by April 1st, And when the current governor became elected, that all changed, it seemed. What changed?
You know, what changed was, I think, as I mentioned to the question earlier, I think it's not a party, Democrat, Republican. I think it's the players involved in that process. And I think when you have a strong governor who makes very clear that he wants an early budget, an on-time budget, and if we don't have it, there's going to be consequences, like not doing continuing resolutions to keep government going over a period of time. Patterson had somewhat of a good idea in that what he did the continuing resolutions with government going on, but less and less spending, which he wanted. But that was a very bad process in the long run because it kept going on and on. You got to have the players that are willing to not only threaten consequences, but judging from the personality of the individual, you know those consequences are actually going to be meted out if it's not done. That's the change. David Patterson, he was in the Senate my first 16 years, and then he became lieutenant governor and then governor. Great guy. He's a wonderful guy. You'd love him speaking here because he's very personable. He's very accomplished. Problem was he was just ill-suited for that position. And when he made a threat, that threat was ignored for about a week, and then he made another threat of something else, and nothing ever followed through on. And that was his problem. Interestingly enough, about that. His second budget, I was ranker on the Finance Committee. He gives it, all the governors give it at the big stage and so forth. So he hadn't arrived yet, and Lieutenant Governor Ravitz was on the stage. You know, and being as shy as I am, I jumped up on the stage before the governor got there and said to the Lieutenant Governor, you know what would be a great idea? I said, if in this budget discussion, the governor simply say, we're not doing any continuing resolutions, just, and then let the legislature stop government, for crying out loud. Oh, that's a great idea. But he came up with the other solution, and I think this governor's got the personality and credibility that he's going to do it.
Good morning. So in response to the question about the school formula, you referred to the item in the governor's agenda that referenced the Medicaid predictable rate structure that could benefit the state. As the governor moves the Medicaid-funded services into managed care operations, I'm wondering how the need for the managed care companies to gain a profit, the need of the state to control the tax revenue provided for Medicaid, can balance with what I worry about is the loss of services for individuals and families who depend on Medicaid. How can the legislators keep an eye on that?
Well, what the governor imposed over the last couple budget sessions is limiting the increase in Medicaid spending to 4% per year. And he's done that, and we've done that. There's no choice other than to cut back spending in Medicaid. And what most people don't focus on, I know everybody realizes, the two big areas in state spending are Medicaid and education. So the more dollars for Medicaid, the less there's going to be for education unless you continue to raise taxes and I think adversely affect the economy. New York State, and I've said this, I said it once, I've said it 100 times, New York State spends more on Medicaid than the next two states combined, Texas and California. More in Medicaid than the next two states combined, California and Texas. Now that's absurd. And how do you then provide for the other services that you need on a reasonable value? Now why is that? The state of New York, the federal government requires certain services. They allow certain optional services where the federal government will help pay for those optional services. We have more optional services than any state in the country. And it's wonderful. And everybody wants to provide for everybody that they can provide for. But realistically, it's such a budget buster that 4%, limiting the increase to 4% when the rate of inflation is less than 2, is incredible. But it was going at an astronomical level. And I've been saying for years, unless we eliminate some of the optional services, we're never going to deal with the budget problem. Let me give you an example. There was a talk about across-the-board cuts. Well, across-the-board cuts are a cop-out, and it's ridiculous, because some programs are important, they got to be done, and you're just hurting people that shouldn't be hurt. I had a group of individuals with severe handicaps that come see me every year, most of which are wheelchair-bound, and I said, look, what? I know the 4% doesn't make any sense. What do you think? And their thought is, well, if we can self-direct our care, we get so many things that we really don't need. But there's things we could use, and we can save you money. And I've been supporting the self-directed care for years, but they're just, I got my reasons why I think it doesn't happen, but that's one thing. One simple example, transportation costs in Medicaid. I have a car that is equipped with all of the equipment that we would need to get me to my doctor's appointment. I have an aide that charges a few dollars an hour, but I am not allowed to have my aide drive my vehicle to my doctor to get me to my appointment. I've got to call a transportation service. Now, I think that that's something that should be addressed. It wasn't. And we had this Medicaid Reform Task Force that the government put together, and it just clipped at the edges of some of the minor things. But for education, whether it's Sandy problems or whether whatever problem, there would be ample education funding to do what would have to be done if we just got somewhat in line with maybe the second largest state in Medicaid costs, not spend more than both. And so I understand your concern and the services that you provide, but we have to be realistic in order to provide what's needed and be very compassionate, but put the budget in control.
I just wanted to follow up with that. About a year or so ago, we had Jason Helgerson, the state Medicaid director, here talking about Medicaid reform. In February, the state health commissioner, Dr. Nirav Shah, will be here to talk about, to give us an update on Medicaid reform, so some of these things we can bring in. My attorney friend here, Catherine Richardson, reminds us that one of the other issues that's out there in Medicaid is the trusts and
the ability the legislature could change that, the ability for people to hide their money into trusts so that they pass it on to the next generation instead of paying for the cost of nursing home, because the biggest part of Medicaid is nursing home coverage.
You're absolutely right. We probably put Colden out of business, the attorney Colden. But realistically, each year, once again, we clip at the edges. It used to be a three-year look-back period. Then it's five-year look-back period when you're transferring assets. But you're absolutely right. There's no logic behind it other than political influence.
Right. And certainly we heard over the years, we've heard a lot about the importance of Medicaid reform and changing the formula for payment from the county executive, both past and present.
Thank you. Thank you.
But more recently, we've been hearing a lot from both the mayor, from Richard Ravitz, and others, both here and in other venues, about the fiscal train wreck that the city is facing. And again, from the mayor and the former lieutenant governor, we hear that the problem is really structural. And it, again, has a lot to do with state mandates, things that the city has to pay for, pension costs, I don't have to tell you, pension costs, healthcare costs for public employees, the whole police, fire, union negotiation. So this is a real and immediate fiscal cliff. And so what do we do about that?
Let me go back to your favorable review of taking some of the costs away from county governments. as far as Medicaid. I was against that. Sometimes I'm the only person against certain things, but I was against that. And let me tell you why. And what happened as a result of us assuming more cost of Medicaid from county governments. The fact of the matter is, when the county governments have some skin in the game, they're the ones who administer the program. And if they have skin in the game and they know that costs exceeding a certain amount are going to be picked up by the state, there's less of an incentive to try to operate efficiently. Onondaga County is one of the most efficient in the state. There's no question about that. No question. Guess what city's not? When the Medicaid expenses started escalating in the double digits, the amount of increase from New York City was astronomical compared to Onondaga County and other counties because they had less skin in the game. And they were able to provide more services for more people, be more flexible in how that was done in order to provide more funding. And the employees there were increased and so forth and so on. So that backfired, I think. On the other hand, the way to do it isn't to share. If you're going to do something, the only way is for the state to take it over completely, including the administration. So the administrators have skin in the game. And there is a movement to try to get that done because the other clearly did not work. Now, the other question was about city governments. Well, I'm old enough that I've served in the school board, the city council, and also the Senate. So I've seen it from all ends. One of the biggest failures of government, state government, I believe, is not dealing with mandate relief. I truly believe that, because you can't demand certain things and not have the funding behind it. But the problem with mandate relief is, if there's negotiated contracts, how do you deal with the high cost of pensions in the city, in the county, in the school district? If they're negotiating contracts with 4% increases, 5% increases, the rate of inflation is 3%, and it includes various benefits through the pension, it's very difficult to regulate. The Constitution says you cannot impair the pension benefits of state constitution of employees. So what do you do? And what we've done, to mixed reviews, to put it mildly, we started a fourth-tier pension plan, so it affects the next group, and a fifth-tier pension reform that the governor pushed very strongly, which will affect things in the future. The biggest mandate cost for school districts is tri-borough. You hear school districts, we need a tri-borough amendment. And basically what that is that when a teacher's contract expires, the step increases that are set forth in the contract, they continue. So in certain instances, teachers, you're negotiating as a school district, and you can't really negotiate because there's no real harm to the other side because they continue having the same benefits and actually increase in benefits. It is politically impossible to do tri-borough. Politically impossible. In fact, who was talking about the education reform panel? I'll give you a preview. Tri-borough isn't going to be mentioned because it's such a political hot potato. So a lot of, and secondly, school districts, mandate relief. One of the biggest mandates and one of the highest costs is special education. How do you cut that huge nut without causing serious problems to people, that kids that need extra help? It's so. What I'm saying, it's not as easy. You mentioned in passing the fire negotiations and the police and so forth, mandatory arbitration. The mayor came to me a couple of years ago and said, you know, one thing that would help us the most immediately that you could do is require arbitrators in these arbitrations to consider or to factor in the ability to pay. Now, you would think that that would be logical. But what arbitrators do is you got one side says this, one side says that, goes in the middle, and then looks at other districts who got more and say, look, this is fair. Now, that simple clause I tried to get through in the budget process, simple clause It never happened. Why it doesn't, it's crazy. But I truly believe they have legitimate points, and these things have to be worked out, and some people are going to suffer if Medicaid is cut back. Some people are going to suffer for a while until the pension costs start getting better under future contracts.
Thank you. Please don't give up. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator DeFrancisco.